market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money. Yep. Our special Sunday mailbag edition. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is the special man himself, the doctor, Dr. Niban Mahati. How are you, buddy?
I'm very good, man. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well, thank you. This Sunday, well, it's Thursday morning, but, you know, we're pretending it's Sunday. This chick is getting old, mate. We're going to have to come up with some sort of new starting point. But in any case, thank you to our listeners who are joining us for this mailbag edition. I'll give a half apology for the length of Friday's podcast episode. If you enjoyed it, then you're welcome. If you hated it, I apologize. Moreover, though, I think it was really good content, and hearing Doc talk about big tech is always worth the price of admission, which frankly is zero, so stop complaining. But in all seriousness, we did let that go a little bit longer than we normally do. That's not our general length. If you enjoyed it, great. If you didn't, then it's not going to happen again. Well, it probably will, but not anytime soon. So, I think it was worth it. I'm not super apologetic, but if it did kind of scare your inbox and podcast feed, then we'll apologize. So, without further ado, mate, let's not make this longer than it needs to be and get straight on with the questions. What do you reckon?
Let's do it. Let's get on with it.
Beautiful. My first one comes from Derek. Derek says, "Hi, Dr. Scott and Dr. Niban. I think you're both worthy of the doctor title." Now, Derek, I'm going to say up front, I have too much respect for my colleague, Mr. Mahati, or Dr. Mahati, and also my dear wife, who is also a doctor, and again, a PhD, not a medical doctor, to even think about accepting that title. So while I appreciate the honorary doctorate you've given me, I shan't be using it because, frankly, the work and effort, energy required, the sheer application, I am not capable, nor have I demonstrated that. So I appreciate the offer, but I won't take it. So there you go. He says, "You can call me Derek. Thanks for the education and the impetus that your podcast has provided me. I've listened for over 2 years and have been a member of a number of services for 1 year, in which time I've been very happy with the results, but I am mindful of taking a long-term view." Thank you, mate. That's very kind. We are glad you're taking a long-term view. We love getting short-term results, but we never expect them. We never want our members to take them for granted because, frankly, the good market giveth and the good market can taketh away. And as we record this on Thursday morning, mate, it's one of the red days on the market. So right now, whatever money we had yesterday, it's a little bit less of it today. So we're familiar with that. But look, we do appreciate it, Derek. Thank you very much for the kind words. All right, mate, he's got a comment and three questions, so let's get to them. Comment. He says, "When two partners in business always agree, one of them is unnecessary." I think he's pointing at the fact that you and I argue a bit. He says, "While you both have similar fundamental philosophies about investing, you are prepared to discuss and share some different perspectives, and I'm sure many listeners like myself appreciate this." So thank you, Derek. Appreciate that, mate. Very kind of you to say. Because, you know, we're not going to stop anytime soon. we're both argumentative and opinionated bastards. So, we're not going to agree with each other for the sake of it. So we appreciate that. You appreciate it. Thank you, mate.
So what's Derek right. saying? Basically that we have random opinions and we just fight and we throw like flamethrowers at each other
I think that's what he's saying. All right.
Okay, fine. Well, we should send Derek a ticket,
we should charge for admission. Exactly.
Well, because it sounds like he's getting a lot of entertainment out of this. And then Derek, you've got entertainment, when you go to the movies and event cinema, it's not free, right?
we'll double the price of the podcast. How about that?
Exactly. I think that's right.
All right. Let's get to his questions. That's question one. "One of my goals this year is to set up a brokerage account to buy US stocks. I currently only have ASX stocks using CompSec, and it might be nice to keep all my records under one website. But I'm a bit sick of giving up 1% on a $3,000 purchase before I even begin. So I like the idea of Charles Schwab's free service for US stock purchases. I understand I need a $25,000 minimum to open an account. Does this balance or the value of stocks..." So he said, "Does the balance or the value of the stocks and cash balance have to remain at least $25,000? I don't know that, Doc. I don't know they have a minimum balance retain requirement, do they? It's just to open an account in the first place. I think you require a $25,000 commitment. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Don't quote us on that. But I think what you're saying is I think what I know as well.
One for Schwab, Derek, but we think that's true. His second question, "I own a number of ETFs. I understand there is a small fee on these. Is this fee taken out of dividends or how is it paid? And can it be claimed against tax?" Good question. Doc?
I actually don't know. Where is the fees paid though?
So I'll grab this one if you want. Fees on ETFs are basically removed from the balance, Derek. So the net tangible asset value of the fund at any point in time is effectively the value of all the cash and shares that the fund holds. and the fund pays itself a fee out of that balance. So think of it like a bank account where the fees are deducted automatically. The amount you have in that bank account is simply the sum total of all the money you've put in, all the interest you've earned, less any fees that have come out, and ETFs work the same way. In terms of tax, I'm pretty sure, in fact, I'm 100% sure, I shouldn't be 100%, I'm 99% sure, and we have a few accountants listening to us who aren't shy of letting me know when I screw this up, when I make tax calls. My understanding is that because it's included in the balance, it's effectively included already in your tax. I don't think you can claim it as an annual expense, but it lowers, a bit like brokerage, it lowers your it lowers the profit you make. You can basically subtract the brokerage from the gain you make and you pay tax on the difference. I'm relatively sure that the ETF fees work the same way.
So he's basically talking about he's talking about the ETF management fee.
Yes, correct.
Right, okay.
Yes. But be aware, of course, there is also brokerage on ETFs as well as management fee, but I think you know that. Question three, I don't know this company at all. I own shares in Fluence, FLC, purchased before I was a member with Motley Fool. Do you have any knowledge or opinions on this company or what metrics I might use to make some educated guesses about its likely future prospects? Do you know Fluence, mate?
A little bit, but not a whole lot. Yeah. So
top line. Do you know enough about what it does to kind of give us a quick thumbnail sketch?
Not enough to be useful. Let me put it that way.
There you go, Derek. So we're going to answer with I don't know rather than give you a bum steer, mate. Derek finishes. Thanks again for your most excellent podcast. Most excellent. I like that. It's very. What was that? Who was that mob? Most excellent. Wasn't Wayne and Garth from Wayne's. What was the other two? Bill and Ted. Most excellent. Thank you again for your most excellent podcast and for giving me greater confidence to invest and a more positive personal financial outlook, Derek. Thank you, Derek. Mate, that's a wonderful question and a wonderful email. Thank you for getting us started, mate. Another one from David. Hi, Scott and Doc. I love your work. Thank you, mate. I also appreciate your valuable insights to four separate emailed questions I've sent you. Wow, okay. Well, obviously, we should be charging David more. In fact, we should because he says, the price of admission, a literal flattery, he says, seems cheap. No, sorry, I mean great value. Yeah, it is, David. So far, you've paid exactly zero for four questions to be answered. We're going to have to look at that, mate. I think we might triple the cost of that one. All right. He says, what sets a stock's price as the market opens? Now, he talks about some price on the morning of. Telstra apparently was trading a certain price and CompSys says it's down, whatever, and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not going to go into the details. It doesn't make great audio. He says, this illustrates a mistake I think I've made as a newbie in assuming and anchoring to the price a share closed at the day before. I have assumed the gains or losses that show up the next day refer to the previous day's close. Now, here's the assumption is actually correct. David, it actually does. So I'll move on for that one. He was concerned, basically, Doc, that the numbers didn't seem to add up. Now, I don't know what David's looking at specifically. It's hard to kind of recreate this because points in time on a CompSys screen, you can't kind of grab or look at. What I reckon David's possibly done is looked at the pre-market price, the indicative price that sometimes CompSec and other brokers show. So I'm going to try and explain this one, mate, and you can jump in and tell me where I'm wrong and help our listeners. But broadly speaking, David is absolutely right in his assumption, although he thought he was wrong, but he's not. The share price change you see reported on the news, on CompSec, anywhere else, is the change versus the last close price. So yesterday, we'll talk about this on Sunday, so it's a bad example, but tomorrow morning on Monday, when you see the share, Telstra shares up 1%, hopefully they're up because I own them, but up 1%, it'll be 1% versus Friday night's close price at about 4:30 in the afternoon when this price is locked down. So let's say it closes at $3. It's not going to, but it just makes my maths easier. It'll be $3.03 if it's up 1% on Monday. And that's exactly how it works, David. So you were right in the first place. In the meantime, though, sometimes before the market, the CompSec and others show an indicative price. And what it basically does is it puts together all of the limit orders that have been placed on its system. And it's saying, okay, look, before the market opens, I've got all these people who are looking to buy at this price, all these people who are looking to sell at this price. And if that happens, then indicatively, the price will probably open up or down. And that's reported on a different line on CompSec. Now, you may not be talking about that, David, for all I know, but my guess is that might be what you're referring to. And that, if that's the case, it's an indicative pre-market price just based on what CompSec thinks might happen if those orders that it already has in its system ready for 10 o'clock in the morning get executed the way they otherwise would go through. But again, that's all that happens. And then basically, once shares actually start trading, the price you see is literally just the last price that shares changed hands, whether that was sometimes on the day of. Sometimes, by the way, shares don't trade for a while in the morning if it's a thinly traded stock. We're not talking about Telstra here, of course, but if it was, I don't know, Doc and Scott's Shoe Emporium, and we only, you know, we trade a couple of times a day. It can be, you know, 11, 11:30 in the morning before the first trade is placed. But generally speaking, the price you'll see on the screen is the last traded price, whether that was today or Friday, or tomorrow or Friday in this case, because we're doing this on a Sunday. But you'll also see the change will be between the last traded price and the previous market's close. In this case, again, it will be Friday afternoon's close. Doc, any more thoughts on that one, mate?
You know, nothing. Can I digress and talk about something just briefly?
Tangents? We don't do tangents on this podcast.
We don't. Okay. So this is just for our listeners.
Yeah,
okay, we were talking about GameStop, which has a GME code. There is another, unfortunately or fortunately, another company with a GME code on the ASX. That's up 40% today. So
you're kidding.
I am not kidding you.
Oh, man.
GME Resources Limited. So
these
please,
guys have been hitting the backside by a rainbow.
but please don't buy. Either way, just, you know, I don't know anything about GME Resources, but just don't play GameStop.
Careful.
GameStop. God. Okay. Anyways, this is a small aside. Let's move
on. I like that, mate. Funnily enough, actually, just a really quick aside to your aside is we've recommended I own shares in a company called Corporate Travel Management. And of course, the company's acronym is CTM. But CTM, I think on the ASX, is Central Minerals or something, rather than Corporate Travel Management, which is CTD. Sometimes two companies with similar names end up having to have different codes just by definition. And I have occasionally heard of a member of ours buying the wrong shares. So be careful. Always check both the ticker and the exchange before you place your trades. It can be very ugly otherwise.
Ticker, exchange, and name. Name is important. You're ultimately buying a company which has a name, not some bloody ticker.
Man. And mate, I've got a bone to pick with our friends at ShareSite. I like ShareSite. I use ShareSite. I pay for ShareSite. Except Stephen emailed us and said, hey, these guys have missed the big one, the TMF podcast with Scott and Doc. Maybe you should set them straight. Now, Stephen included an email attachment. They had the top 50 finance and investing podcasts. Apparently, for some unknown reason, they don't include Motley Fool Money. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't use ShareSite as a result. I'm not saying you should definitely email them and suggest that they've missed the best podcast in the country. But if you were inclined, feel free to let them know they've missed the very best podcast in Australia, because I don't know how they could possibly find 50 that were even close to as good as ours, let alone better, Doc. What's going on?
Oh, I don't know. Like, I mean, how could this happen is the only thing I can...
It's a travesty, mate. This GameStop stuff, that is small bickies compared to the misleading nature of ShareSite's podcast blog by... staring to suggest we're not the top 50. There is something funny going on here, and when I get to the bottom of it, someone will pay. That or my feelings just hurt. I'm not entirely sure. All right, thank you, Stephen. Here's a question from, I don't know if we've given the name, so I'm not going to mention the email address. All right, here we go. Huge thanks to both of you for producing an easy to understand, informative, and entertaining show. Thank you. It's Achu, actually. Achu is the name. I've just scrolled down a little bit. A special thanks to Scott, thank you, for showing a lot of empathy in his email newsletters at the height of the market crash last year. That was exactly what was needed for retail investors like me to stay the course. Well, thank you. That's really gratifying. Thank you. I appreciate it. My question is about Kogan. I was fascinated to learn in one of your past episodes about the background of Myer and David Jones and department stores in general, and how they were trendy and relevant in a not-so-globalized world. Andy says how they stopped being that once the global brands were able to set up shops and bring fast and cheaper fashion and goods to more or less every suburb in the cities. And you're right, that's a really, it is a kind of cool history lesson there. Recently, he says, I was looking to buy a shoe and was comparing a particular model at Kogan and the shoe brand's websites. While the price and shipping cost was exactly the same, the brand's website was able to give me the more description and specification of the shoe and other relevant details. The one-size-fits-all generic website of Kogan couldn't give that info. I ended up buying the shoe from the brand's website. Achoo, that hurts. I own Kogan shares. That hurts me deeply. Anyway, he says, which brings me to the question. COVID has accelerated the move online of many retailers and brands. Platforms such as Shopify and Etsy are making it easy for retailers to establish an online presence cost-effectively. Shipping and last-mile delivery are also being made faster and cheaper by Uber and others, essentially nullifying the first-mover advantage of Kogan. Niche and specialist online retailers such as Chewy.com, Wayfair in the US, and to some extent Temple & Webster are chipping away at the total market of all-in-one retailers like Kogan. So, will Kogan go the way of Meijer and Target in the future? Interested to hear your thoughts on this. Regards, Achu. I like that. That's a really good question. Doc, I own Kogan share, so I'm probably going to be... I'll try and be unbiased, but I can't ever claim to be. So, you're not a Kogan shareholder. What do you reckon, mate? Is Kogan the next stop on the way to further diversification, or do the one-size-fits-all, the get-it-all-in-one-place retailers like Kogan or Amazon or something else have a role to play in the future?
First of all, this is a brilliant question. I love it when people think like this. This is great. This is absolutely beautiful way to think. So... here's what I think about this. First of all, I'll just make one small correction. I would not call Kogan a first mover, right? I mean, Kogan is actually a late mover in many ways because, I mean, online retail has been going on for like now 10 years, right? So it's a late mover in that sense.
Yeah.
The thing, and he's absolutely right to say that, you know, basically platforms have made it really easy to go online. And there's a long tail of online retailers. So you think about what's happening via things like, you know, these platforms, then you have a long tail of retailers that you can access through various platforms. And he's absolutely right that there's, you know, the ease of delivery, the ease of going online, the ease of hosting, the ease of payments. There's basically anybody can be online. And in fact, if a business is not online, they're actually just basically committing suicide themselves. There's no reason not to be. So I think all those things are absolutely correct. So I think a couple of ways to think about this. One is there's always going to be people and companies that are not going to be actually going online. Right? At least that's how I think. Or are going to be slow to go online. So there's going to be share taken on that front by Kogan and others, Temple & Webster and whatever not, you know, think of, and all the other small ones that have decided to go online. That's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that should allow companies like Kogan and Temple & Webster to take share from those people who are slow to move. I do think he's right to think about the total upside. I think that's a very valid way to think about it, is that the total upside now is, in many ways, if this was 10 years ago versus now, I think is different because in many ways your pie is going to be divided. But at the same time, you also have to think that how much of the other people's pies. I think it's how much share you're going to steal and how much the market is going to grow is the real question. Yeah. So I think it's a very valid question to think about. There's more competition now than there was in the past. I think that's really valid. I think on the other hand, though, I mean, you have to think about comparing Kogan, like-for-like comparison, right? I mean, Kogan is a pretty capital-light model, if you think about it. From a retailer's point of view, it's a capital-light model, right? It doesn't have store footprint. It has distribution centers and stuff that it has to pay for. It doesn't have to pay for stores. It doesn't have that kind of employee footprint. It can use other things. So it's got a pretty lightweight model. It's profitable already, or generates cash at least, and is profitable, so it can continue growing. So I think, you know, I don't think it's a net negative in any way, but yeah, it's a good question to think about the total addressable market. I think that is a valid point, but again, I think, you know, this doesn't have to be a winner's take all market. That's my bottom line. This doesn't have to be winner takes all market. It's not that there's going to be a single winner. There's not even going to be a couple of winners. There's going to be multiple winners in this market. I think the dynamics are a little bit different than it was. Like, it's not my last comment. I think you should not buy Kogan thinking it's going to be Amazon-like. It's not going to be Amazon-like because I think the era and time are different. I think that comment, I think, is spot on. That doesn't mean it's not a good investment, right? So those are, again, two completely different things. And remember, Kogan is profitable at this stage versus, you know, similar stage business, Amazon was not profitable, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's the way I think about it. So it's a brilliant question. Lovely.
Agree. Perfect. I'm going to add just another quick thought. You've covered it beautifully, Doc. What I think I would add to Archie's observation about the Meijer and DJ's department stores thing is my view is that while the others have set up new stores, it's because specifically the Westfields of the world became the new David Jones or Meijer. They became the department store, right? So once upon a time, you went to, I vividly remember as a kid going to Broadway in Sydney, and there was a Grace Brothers, it was then called, and it was the place you went to get all of the labels in one place because shopping centers didn't really exist in any meaningful way. They kind of started in the 60s, so they're on the way, but they didn't really exist in a large sense. Once you get the shop, the shopping mall, the shopping center, they're effectively just large department stores. And so Meijer and DJ's struggled specifically because someone else said, hang on, we can offer more, bigger, better, all under one roof. It's a bigger roof and there's food and there's entertainment and there's all that stuff. So basically kind of, you know, Westfield just did a department store on steroids is the shopping center. And so to some degree, that hurt the department store. I think to some degree, the story is also true of Kogan in exactly the same way because to my mind, if you want a particular shoe, let's say it was Nike. I don't know what shoe it was. Let's say it was Nike. You have to go to Nike's website and buy it. But if you want a sports shoe, you're not sure what you want, you'll probably go to Kogan and look for it. Or if you want a TV, if you want a Samsung 65-inch with this model number or whatever, you might go and find the best place to buy it. And you need to be the cheapest price, by the way, if you're, and it sounds like Kogan was, if you want the sale. But if you're looking to buy a television or a phone, going just to the retailer's website or just to the wholesaler or the manufacturer's website, I should say the brand owner's website, you have to have already made that decision. So you'll always have people go between Kogan and Apple's website, Kogan and Nike's website, Kogan and Samsung's website, I suppose. But broadly, they are the shopping center, the shopping mall, the department store, whatever version you want to use, whatever analogy. Which, you know, you could always have gone to, I don't know, the Tiffany store in town in the middle of the city rather than go to the jewelry counter at DJ's or the jewelry shop at the Westfield. So I think to some degree, to your point, Doc, it won't be winner takes all. Different types of shopping occasions, shopping missions, as the boffins call it, will have different things and they'll absolutely coexist. I completely agree. All right, next question.
I actually did not answer the question, the direct question he asked, which is, no, I don't think Kogan is going the Meijer or the DJ's way. I thought I let him make it explicit, even though I talked about terminals. I was just trying to give my color. But I think it's again different models, although those two things are completely different models. So, nice.
Thank you, buddy. No, appreciate it. Question from James. Hi there. I'm an EO, Extreme Opportunities, and SA, Share Advisor subscriber, our services mate, so thank you, James, with a question for the podcast. I bought an EO recommendation in late March. It was PointsBet. Sorry to give the good news away, Doc, but our listeners will appreciate, I'm sure you'll appreciate when I read the rest of the line, which is, and I'm up over 580% on this stock alone. Thanks, EO. Nice work, Doc. My question relates to some options I was issued when I took up the share placement last year. Now, this email was sent a week ago, so the price are out of touch, but we'll go with the concept. The strike price for these options is $13, apparently, and the shares are currently around $14.80. So that would say that the shares are currently trading at $1.80 higher than the current share price, than the strike price. The thing I can't wrap my head around, he says, is my brokerage is telling me that my options are currently trading at $3.56. Shouldn't they ever only trade at the difference between the buy price and the current price? How are they selling for almost double? All right, Doc. I don't know the answer to this one. You tell me.
this is relatively easy. So options are derivative instruments, right? So if you have a call option, it gives you the right to buy the particular underlyings, in this particular case, points bets, at whatever that strike price is, $12, right? Yep. So let's say that, you know, the strike price is $12. It basically says you can effectively buy it at $12 now.
Yep.
And the shares might be at $13, in which case, you know, you actually, like, you know, you basically have like a $1 difference, right?
Yep.
Now, the thing is that options also have an expiry date, right?
Yep.
And because these options expire in the future, what it effectively is saying is there's what's called time value. Because what we don't know is what if the shares are going to be $20 in 3 years' time and the options expire in 3 years' time, right? So the options market basically is including some modeling that says, well, you know, there is some time left, anything can happen, you know, the stock could dip, the stock could go up. And for that reason, we're going to ask you to pay a little bit more in this particular case.
So the options holders are betting the price will go up even further, and they're factoring some of that in the current price.
It's sort of right, but they're not betting that it's going to go up a lot, right? Because if it was betting it'll go up a lot, if that says 12, strike price is 12, and if the options market thought that it was going to go to 20, then 20 minus 12 should be baked into the options price. The options price should really reflect what the options market thinks at this time, the future price of this in a probabilistically distributed way, right? Of course, now, a couple of caveats here. This is what the options market thinks for, and the options market, not just the whole, the options market in this particular company, which may be thinly traded, and therefore it might not mean anything. So there's that reflection built into it, right? So it's not a very liquid market and things like that. So basically it's called time value. You're paying up some time value because there's some time left for the end date of the call.
Nice, there you go. And one of the two will be right, right? So if the shares don't gain, the options holders will lose money. If the shares go up, the options, because it's an option, it's a not only a derivative instrument, it's kind of a leverage gain, right? Because if you're paying $1.80 to get a bigger gain, there's also some upside leverage there. So they operate just on a different plane, a different kind of the line's on a different angle to the actual shares themselves, right? Bigger downside, bigger upside in percentage terms.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Cool. Thanks, James. Really good question. He's got another one, mate. He says, another question I have is around exercising these options and then selling the shares, or am I better off just selling these options directly? What are the pros and cons? So as you say, Doc, in theory, when the market's efficient, and it isn't often or always, as we know from GameStop on Friday, but when it is, in theory, they should be kind of the same thing, right? If the pricing is done correctly, then selling the options or converting and then selling the shares should be the same outcome at some future point. Do you have a general view on what not we won't tell James what he should do, or even necessarily in this case points bet, though feel free to. But generally speaking, do you think our listeners should just sell the options at a reasonable price, or exercise, buy the shares and then sell the shares?
Well, my rule of thumb, like, I actually don't like it when companies actually force you to buy options, because you're being like forced to buy part of a transaction. If I was buying options myself, so I do buy sometimes call options. So what I tend to do is I think of them as a share replacement, or a stock replacement, right? Right. So if the shares are trading at $100, instead of forking out 100 times, you know, $110,000, I could buy exposure to that company and I can pick a lower strike price of, say, $50, and I might actually land up paying like $55 per exposure to 100 shares. Mm. And that sort of prevents, that helps, that saves me from downside risk as well, because I've picked a lower strike price. In this case, I really don't have I think your best course of action really is to just hold on till the expiration, right? Because this is a growth company, it's growing pretty quickly. If it keeps executing, then there's a good chance that the share price is meaningfully higher. If the share price is meaningfully higher, then at that point you can decide whether you want to take the shares at that price or just sell your calls in the market for the difference, right? Because as you get closer and closer to expiration, that's when it doesn't have any time value. It basically will have intrinsic value, which is going to be share price minus the option strike price, right? So that's what I think I would do. But again, this is really hard, because this is, you have to, if you need the money and then you can get rid of it, you're going to get like whatever that in dollar or something per option that you hold, and probably hold options in increments of 100. So you get something back. Again, there's no perfect answer for this, unfortunately.
Nice. Thank you, mate. I see no value in converting then selling, rather than convert, just selling the options. If the market's reasonably efficient, you should be getting similar value for both trades. If you want to hold the shares, obviously different thing. Or if you want to, if you aim to hold them for a longer term, then that's a different question, I would have thought. But again, as you say, Doc, there's no perfect answer. So that's a range of thoughts, a range of options you have to think about how you might want to use that money.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, let's go to Alex. Alex, hi Scott and Doc. I love the pod and hearing your insights. Thank you, Alex. I'm a subscriber to the Dividend Investor Service, capably run by our mate Ed Vesely. Well done. I also invest in Sol Pats, or Washington H. Sol Pattinson. I own shares for the record, so let me disclose that up front. Recently, Sol Pats have launched a convertible note offering. What are the pros and cons of convertible note offerings? Perhaps it has to do with your investment horizon, financial situation, life stage, and risk tolerance, Alex asks. Would convertible notes be worthwhile, or would I be better off spending my money on more dividend and or growth stocks? Foolishly yours, Alex. Great question, Alex. Doc, you and I discussed this in our group Slack channel only a few days ago. Maybe it was late last week. In terms of Soul Patts offering, I'm going to go through the detail of it, and you can give your thoughts, and I'll wrap up with mine. So Soul Patts is going to, or has raised $225 million. The interest, and it's a convertible note. What that means is they pay interest, it's a loan, and then the loan holder has the option of converting that loan into shares or being repaid. So in that circumstance, it's like saying I'll lend you $100, Doc, and in 5 years' time, you give me the $100 back, or I can take $100 worth of shares that you might own, for example. It's an imperfect example because this is a company, not an individual investor, but the same kind of idea. You either get the money back, or you can choose the option of having shares in the company instead. And Soul Patts is raising it at, get this, 0.6% per annum. So they've basically get someone else to write a loan to give them $225 million with an interest rate of 0.6%. That's pretty good. At the end of that term, though, either they've got to have the $225 million and give it back to the people, or those people who wrote the loan get to take $225 million worth of Soul Patts shares. Now, there is a strike price difference. I don't think we'll get into that in a whole lot of detail, but effectively, that's the option. So for Soul Patts, they get a lower interest rate than you would have got almost anywhere else, but shareholders might have to give up some upside in the company's share price because Soul Patts will issue more shares to make this happen, which dilutes the rest of us who own shares. Now, Doc, firstly, is that a reasonable summary? And secondly, what do you reckon the pros and cons are?
I think that's a very reasonable summary. I mean, you've described the pros and cons really. Like, I mean, the pro is that you're getting money at a very low interest rate. The con really is that you're going to dilute if the share price is materially higher. So, I mean, in many ways, the funny thing could be that, you know, this is a five-year, let's say this is a five-year hybrid, then, or convert, then if the share price goes nowhere for 5 years, mm-hmm. it actually may work out. And then after, in the sixth, seventh, eighth year, actually goes up,
that's right.
Then it'll work out well. Like, then it works out really in the favor of investors. Of course, then that at the fifth year, then Soul Patts has to pay back in cash, right? So there's, they'll have to have the cash to pay back the debt at that point in time. So assuming they have the cash, then that's okay. If they don't have the cash, they'll have to refinance or do another convert at that point. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know. I mean, I think the only thing I'll say is the 25% above current share price, that's a pretty low mm-hmm. threshold. Like, I mean, right. Basically, if the share price goes up only 25%, if that's what the management, I mean, that's a very low bar. Typically, I've seen this sort of deal. This is very common in the American market, but the share price at which it will convert is typically at least double or more of where it is today. So, I mean, the 25% higher stood out to me, and maybe the 25% higher was probably the requirement to get that low finance rate.
Yeah, exactly. There's no free lunch, right?
Yes, no free lunch, right? So because otherwise I would have expected the Soul Patts would probably be getting money at 2%, 2.5%. And the fact that they're getting it pretty much close to zero comes with a cost. And then that's this particular case, it comes with cost of equity. So that's that. I mean, it all depends on what you do with the money, right? Really. Like, I mean, if you do something really, you know, great with the money, then it's a small dilution to take, right? And the shares go up tenfold. Nobody's going to complain about, you know, the dilution. Right. If the shares go up fivefold, nobody's going to complain about the dilution. But if the shares go up only 30%, people are going to complain about the dilution at that point. So that's that.
Nice one, mate. I like that. Look, this is this the loan is about 3% of the company's value for what it's worth. So it's not a huge impost of dilution either way, even if it's fully converted. As Doc says, it's a 25% increase. So the share price has to go up for the company or the lenders to want to convert to make it worth their while. You wouldn't convert otherwise because there's no point paying more than the then current market price. So the lender is betting they get a little bit of money to wait and they get a cheap entry price into the shares. So it's kind of it's an options trade of sorts, right? You get to get some sort of money in the meantime, a very, very small interest rate in the meantime, and a potentially biggish upside, but obviously no guarantee of the upside. And in a worst case scenario for the lender, the best they're going to get is 0.6% a year for 5 years and then get their money back, which is a reasonably rubbish outcome. Of course, if the share price doubles in the meantime, they get a really cheap entry price because they're going to buy it. You know, 25% increases, docks it on the current price. The shares by then are double. And so you get to buy at a really cheap discount and you don't have to exercise that until the last minute so you know whether or not you're going to get some value. So the pros and cons depend on who you are, right? We can talk about it from the company's perspective. From an investor's perspective, do you want to do that? Well, you kind of – I don't love convertibles. I don't – it's a bit the same as what do they call those things? What do the banks offer, those convert hybrid notes? You kind of – you know, convertibles, you're getting some upside potentially – and you're not getting a massive amount of downside. If the company doesn't go broke, you at least get your face value of your loan back. So I guess there's some value there in downside protection. The worst you can do is get your money back. So that's, again, assuming they don't go broke. The worst is absolutely the company goes broke, you don't get your money back. But for some company like Soul Patts, the worst you're reasonably going to do is get your money back. So that's a pretty good downside protection. You do get some upside potential if the shares are higher because you get to buy in 5 years' time at a price below the then current share price, which is a guaranteed upside if it happens. So you kind of they're kind of nice, and you get something paid in the meantime. When cash rates are zero, you're getting 0.6, so it's something. I've got to say, though, to your point, Doc, about the gains, you really only want to do this if you desperately want to protect your downside or you think you're going to get big upside in the share price and make it worthwhile. Equally, from Soul Patts' perspective, you're only going to do this at that deal, and as you say, it's a trade-off between the rate, interest rate and the conversion. You're only going to do it if you think that the money is going to be better than what you've got now. It is a lower cost of debt than their current debt, so they're benefiting from some degree by rolling over some debt to a lower price. But again, as current investors, I'm a shareholder, my ownership is diluted if they do convert at that future point and the strike price is too low. As Doc says, if it's not 50% or 100% higher than now, that's a tough one. I will say, Doc, for what it's worth, I don't think it's super unreasonable as a mix. Given Soul Patts not a hyper-growth business, I mean, no one's going to lend Soul Patts money on a conversion if they double in 5 years, because the chance of Soul Patts business doubling in 5 years is not, you know, it's not the slam dunk. I mean, it may happen, which would be great for me as a shareholder. But I don't know too many lenders who are going to lend money on that assumption, given it's a reasonably conservative conglomerate. It's, you know, if you're lending money to Apple or Tesla, you might be happy to make that bet. I wouldn't expect Woolworths to be able to do that deal either, by the way. Get a double in 5 years, it's just not going to happen unless strange things happen. If the shares are overvalued, by the way, this is a great deal for Soul Patts. So I have to say, part of me did think, hang on, if they're so keen to do this deal, give them a conversion at a 25% premium to the current price, is that saying the current management think that shares are maybe overvalued? And it's a question mark I don't really have an answer to, but it did exercise my brain. So it's only right that I mention it here for full disclosure. I'm not too worried about it. I'm not selling my shares. I'm not changing anything. As I said, it's 3.5% of the current market value. So even if it is diluted entirely, it's not immaterial, and I shouldn't wave it away, so that's not important, but it's not going to have a material impact on my or the company's returns moving forward. And if they get a cheaper cost of debt to do it, I can't get worked up either way particularly. But I have to say, I'd much rather be a shareholder than hold those convertible notes. How about you, mate?
Oh, I think so. The convertible notes, I mean, in the worst case, basically don't return you anything, right?
Yes. You get your 0.6 and then your money back.
Yeah. You're getting money back. So, I mean, it's low downside, but the upside is also, it's capped by time as well, right? I mean, they have to deliver within a certain time. So,
Yeah. It's a bet I wouldn't make, but other people are prepared to. And, you know, hey, I mean, yeah. You know, if I could put money down and get, an upside in 5 years' time, it's worth something, but I'd happily buy the shares. Now, at the current price, not worry about the 25% upside, then get the full upside from now if I bought the shares. So I do that, yeah. But each to their own. We're saying, by the way, too, in the meantime, Soul Patts' yield is probably 2-odd%. So buying the shares would give you a 4x return on the income over the next 5 years in the meantime, even before you started. So I don't think it's a terrible deal for Soul Patts. I don't think it's not a great deal for the lenders. But if you're in the debt market, you're a different type of investor for different reasons. And capital protection is probably a reasonably important component of your life in a way that I'm not as fixated on. All right, next one comes from David. I like this one. You'll like this too, Doc. Dear Scott and Doc, love your work, gentlemen. Thank you, David. I've noticed one of the secret catalysts that can cause an inflection point to be reached for a software company in recent times has been when a company transitions from perpetual licensing to a SaaS model of recurring monthly or yearly fees. I'm going to stop right here, Doc. Talk to us about perpetual licensing versus SaaS.
Yeah, so perpetual licensing, as the perpetual means forever, and license means, well, license is the right. So it basically says you have the right to use the software that's given to you in its current form forever. Mm-hmm. Sometimes there's what's called an annual maintenance attached to that. What that basically means is that, well, whenever that annual maintenance comes up, you can expect to get some mods, upgrades, and things like that on some cycle. Mm-hmm. and typically in an annual cycle. So yeah, you buy a piece of software, use that piece of software forever for a paid price. So that's perpetual license.
Okay. Great, thank you. And SaaS, obviously, hopefully our listeners know, but it is the opposite, not the opposite of that, but it's a different way of doing it where you don't pay anything up front, but you pay a usage fee on a regular basis, right?
Yeah, so SaaS is basically software as a service, which is basically a clever way of saying that we give you the license to use a particular software on an ongoing basis and for a fee, which could be, you know, some companies will charge you yearly in advance, some will charge you monthly in advance, some will charge you quarterly in advance. But the other thing that you get with that is you keep using the software as long, you can use the software as long as you pay for it. Mm-hmm. And in return for that, what you get is you get pretty much the, you know, the latest version of the software. You always have the latest version, the latest and the greatest, and all the new features and things like that. The world has used to be mostly perpetual licenses and has slowly but steadily moved away from perpetual licenses to, you know, these regular SaaS-style recurring revenue. It's recurring because, you know, it's recurring in the sense that you have to keep paying for using it versus paying it once for using it forever. That's where the recurring comes from. And the world has sort of moved away from that to this side.
It's funny too. So SaaS is better for businesses that are offering it because they get regular amounts of income. It's not lumpy. It tends to be an easier sell to their customers. From a customer perspective, I've certainly been in businesses where someone says, hey, can you pay us $100,000 up front for all this software to be installed? And the CFO normally says, no, I'm not going to make that capital expenditure because it's seen as a one-off cost. But if you have a software as a service option, it's a what they call it, operating expenditure, and CFOs take a different view. This is funny because there's no real reason for it, but it seems to work, and SaaS companies have exploited this. I don't mean that in a negative way, but a CFO is going to say, yeah, you can pay $10,000 a year, no worries. But if you want to pay $100,000 up front, that's a whole big problem. Now, you might pay that $10,000 a year for the next 25 years, in which case you've well and truly overpaid or more than paid for the upfront cost. But for budgeting, for cash flow purposes, for a whole lot of other reasons, SaaS is great for the SaaS company, but also for the customer. Now, here's the rest of David's question. The fundamentals take a hit, he says, as this process runs. And it's true, right? So instead of paying the $100,000 up front, if I'm the software company, I get $100,000, I book $100,000 revenue, I'm a genius. But if I go SaaS instead, well, I only get $10,000 for that first year. And so my revenue's fallen by 90% on that particular customer. These are arbitrary numbers. The proportions can be different for different companies, but just work with it. At this stage, it's like, hang on, that company just had a 90% fall in revenue. That's terrible. And the costs are the same, so the profit looks lower. All that stuff happens. So that's where the fundamentals take a hit, as David says, as this process runs, back to his question. But then the company emerges as a winner as the process completes. RPM Global is one example, he says, and maybe Altium is another. Now, David's a bit bullish here. David, don't mind you for asking. We won't probably answer this in full, but let's go with it. Can you give us a list of all the companies that you can think of that are presently making this transition? They may be undervalued on a short-term basis, but should reap growth advantages as they complete the process. Do you think the market has already noticed this phenomenon and moved to eliminate this potential advantage? Full on, gents. David. Now, David's dead right, Doc. RPM Global is a company that we've recommended at ShareAdvisor. Have you guys recommended it? Yeah, I think you might have. There you go. So you've picked it nicely, David. And I won't speak for you, Doc. Feel free to. From our perspective at ShareAdvisor, that is exactly one of the key things we think is going on here. The company, I think, is undervalued, myself and Andrew Leggett, on the basis of that transition continuing to roll out. That's a decent way through it. But that was a very significant part of the investment case was exactly that. The companies are being valued currently on an old perpetual licensing business, but the SaaS stuff isn't being underappreciated by the market. Now, as David said, it's not exactly a surprise anymore. Plenty of businesses are doing or have done this. RPM is one such business. He said Altium is another. I think Altium is pretty much all the way through that, Doc, I would say. It is a recommendation of mine at Motley Fool million-dollar portfolio, so for full disclosure. But I kind of think it's kind of finished that. It's now just in general growth mode as a SaaS business. Do you have a different perspective on Altium?
Yeah, it's a slight... I don't think you're incorrect. I think you've described it correctly. I think the thing with Altium that is... So there are two components to this transition of licenses, right? So Altium also used to do perpetual licenses. Then there's this phenomenon. When you do perpetual licenses, you're basically giving people software to have at one go. That's a much easier fodder for licensing theft and illegal software. So I think what he's talking about here is there is, you know, many software companies that used to be perpetual license givers or, you know, distributors have a large pool of users who have outdated software or using software sort of legally without paying for it. There's an option to actually try to transfer over them to the modern generation software and to bring them over to the SaaS side. So this is, there's a meaningful chunk of users in North America, in China, and other parts of the world where Altium could actually make that happen. And that's part of their push. So I think that's what he's, and then that should all add to the SaaS revenue. So that's a meaningful thing to consider.
Nice, mate.
I don't have anything else to add to this.
David wants to know, can we give me a list of all the companies that are making this transition? I've got to say, I don't have any. I'm not being sneaky. I don't really have a list handy of companies that I think are in the middle of this. We found RPM and grabbed that one about 6 months ago, I think it was. We've done okay with that. It's not certainly not through the roof yet, so it's still a buy for us at ShareAdvisor. But David may well own it, given he mentioned it. I can't think of any. I mean, again, I'm not suggesting there aren't any. I just haven't got any that come to mind that meet that criteria. Others in that kind of space going from perpetual to SaaS. There's plenty of new SaaS companies that are SaaS all the way from scratch. Anything else that comes to mind for you that kind of meet that criteria?
Yeah, nothing really comes to mind. Again, the key thing to remember is that there aren't that many old, well-established software companies on the ASX,
that's
right?
True.
There's not that much opportunity for transformation. Yeah. And then the stuff that we have seen are smaller companies listing lately, which are mostly SaaS by birth. Yeah. Right. So there isn't that. I mean, you know, again, RPM Global is a special case because it's a mining software, which, you know, probably was
Integrated Research is probably the only other one I think I've made that I think it's pretty much done now. It was, we recommended it back in 2011. I think it's ShareAdvisor. My predecessor Dean recommended it when we started that service. I'm pretty sure that's pretty much through that curve as well. So yeah, the company I can think of that's old enough to be in that space.
Yeah, I don't know technology one that well. Maybe technology one has got some sort of transition going on, but again, this is not. It's, I think this sort of trend has mostly played out. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that the market sometimes doesn't appropriately value SaaS companies, right? I mean, RPM Global, there's a bit of a dislocation in valuation one can think about. Yeah.
Awesome, thank you, buddy. Really big question. We'll probably finish on this one, Doc, because we were a little bit. We took a few liberties with Friday's podcast, so we'll keep this one a bit. I won't say shorter, just not as long as that one. Let's go with question from David. I like this. Bernard. Here we go. Hi there, Scott and Doc, or should it be El Presidente and King Doc? I think I'm okay with that. You okay with that?
I'm fine with that.
I'm a subscriber to Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities, Stock Advisor in the USA, and Rule Breakers, and I try to read as much Motley Fool content and listen to as many podcasts as possible, with you guys being my numero uno favorite podcast. Thank you, mate. He says, yes, it's 11 T stars from me. Do we have, is 11 T an option on iTunes yet? Have you fixed that with Tim?
I am going to talk to him right after this.
With all the earnings growth, sure they can afford to add 11 T stars as an option for their podcast rating, is all I'm saying.
I think it makes sense. I'll call him using my new iPhone on my new AirPods, and then maybe he'll listen to me.
Nice. All right, here we go. I have a question, he says, about restarting my super portfolio again once I move it from an industry fund to net wealth. And I've got an answer, re-adding up. Here we go. I'm about to move my whole superannuation portfolio worth six figures and built up over 25 years to net wealth, and would appreciate your thoughts. I know your views are general in nature, not specific advice, etc. Thank you, that's true. Letting you know, I have a stomach for volatility. I like the next new shiny stock. I tend to buy in thirds up to my initial 1% to 3% stake in a business. I suffer from the endowment effect and I'm a recovering double down value trap victim. I'm in this for the long term, initially 15 years or so until retirement, and then until I die. My portfolio outside super has approximately 50 stocks, global in focus, mostly Motley Fool Australia and USA picks, and nearly all are spanking the ASX and the S&P since 2018. Hence my confidence in moving to manage my super myself. Now, you asked some questions, and I will say, Bernard, the more information you give us, by the way, in these podcast questions, the less we can help you, ironically, because the more detailed your question, the closer it gets to personal advice, because when we start considering all the components you put in, ASIC starts to consider it personal advice. So we will do our best to answer some of this question. He says, should I? And he gives us the options. Just eyes closed, replicate the portfolio outside super with a new super portfolio? Or should I take the opportunity to trim the weeds, even if I think some companies could still do well in the next 5 years? Should I buy stocks up to my position limit or use my usual thirds approach? Should I buy all on day one, going against Doc's suggestion to buy stocks at a similar rate you accumulate the cash? Should I buy all new stocks in different companies with a different strategy? Or insert your much better suggestion here. So I'll start with this one, mate. Just one quick thought, and then I will let you go and I'll come back some thoughts. My first thought, Bernard, is actually one, here's one option. And you might like this, and that's okay. I would say consider not doing it at all. And I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying consider not doing it at all. Here's my thinking. If you're in an industry fund right now, they possibly have the opportunity for you to buy stocks directly or ETFs directly in that super fund. And that may be sufficient. It may not. May be sufficient to do what you want to do and also keep your costs really low. My concern for some people, perhaps many people, depending on your super balance, is I don't want you to go from a low fee scenario to a higher fee scenario unless you have a high degree of confidence you can more than cover the increase in fees. Now, if you can, you think you can, that's fine. Just be really mindful that with, I won't say small balance, it's a big balance, six figures, but depending on how much you're paying for the new platform, I don't want any upside to be eaten up by that change to platform. So just as with all self-managed super options, if they work for you for your own reasons, fantastic, go for it. I'm not talking about you, particular Bernard, I'm talking about everyone listening. If super works, self-managed super works for you, go for it. I have one, Doc has one. They work for us, but then we're in the trade. But for many, many people, actually even most people, keeping a super low cost industry fund and taking advantage of most super funds options to actually go and select or direct the stocks you buy within that fund actually might be better financially than doing it yourself. So I'm not saying don't do it yourself. I'm just saying consider not doing it yourself. But if you're going to, Doc, what should you do?
I really don't know. The problem is that there are too many questions there that I don't know exactly where to start from.
Let me break it back.
Yeah.
If you were going to liquidate your super portfolio today, get rid of it altogether, but you kept your personal portfolio as it is, and then you had to go and redeploy that money, how would you, let's say, I'll pick a number for fun, but not to say it. So Bernard says six figures. Let's say 100 grand. Let's say you've got 100 grand portfolio. You sell it all, move it from one structure to another, and you find yourself in a couple of weeks' time with 100 grand cash in a super fund, self-managed in this case. How would you go about redeploying that cash? Would you kind of buy individual positions? Would you buy in thirds? Would you replicate your current portfolio and just say, well, this is my best idea, so I'll do the same in and out of super? How would you think from scratch about setting up an SMSF with a lump sum of cash? Does that help? Or make it harder?
That's a very generic, generic answer to that is that you always buy your best ideas, right? So you buy your best ideas, and I just like to buy slowly, so I wouldn't deploy the entire fund at one go. I would spread that fund over a period of time, some small period of time, but I would do that, and I would just buy my best ideas, right? I mean, basically I'd buy the best companies on a value profit upside adjusted basis that I can, while making sure the portfolio is diversified, which in other words, it's going to pretty much look like my portfolio as is, like basically look close to my portfolio. So that's what I would do, but I don't, again, there might be different ways for running your your super, right? I mean, I do different things in my super than I do outside the super, There are legitimate reasons for that, which are personal circumstances based, which could, again, so I think that's the hard part. But if I was to build a portfolio, I'd build a portfolio that I like, basically. My last point would be, again, if I already own stuff and I have to sell it, did you have to pay capital gains on that? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of transaction movement that is happening. So, I mean, it better be worthwhile to make the transaction movement is the, I guess, there must has to be some other, if it can't be done in the current setup or one can't buy what they want to buy, that's my only other thought. But, yeah.
I like that, mate. I, I know, but like we're stock guys, right? We're supposed to, yeah, do your SMSF, go on, you know, buy your own stocks. We'll give you the best ideas, and we'll do our level best to do that. And hopefully, we'll continue to beat the market. So I have a high degree of confidence in our ability as a business to keep helping our members in really advantageous ways. But we're not the, you know, we get the luxury of not being so mercenary and commercial that we have to give you bad advice to do it. Not that others would necessarily, but each to their own. But I will say, yeah, I like just be careful on that one. I like Doc. I would absolutely not let. So you talk about the endowment effect. I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a bit of anchoring there too, right? So one of the best things I've ever heard, and no one actually does it. We shouldn't, because it costs you a fortune in taxes, is to always think about the portfolio you own as if you had to cash out every night. And next morning, the question would be, would you buy the same things given the choice? And that's the only thing you should be thinking about when it comes to this is literally, if you do it, exactly that, cashing everything out and saying, right, where do I put my money? And if you wouldn't buy the same portfolio tomorrow morning that you own today, that's okay. But then make some changes to reflect that. As Doc said, buy your best ideas, make sure you're holding your best ideas, adding to your best ideas. Now, obviously being careful of things like diversification and portfolio weightings and all that kind of stuff. So those matter, and you really should be mindful of that. But just keep that in mind as you think about how to build up your portfolio. I would absolutely do that. In terms of buying slowly, I think it probably makes the most sense. I've said before, the mathematically rational decision is probably over time, on average, to commit the money as quickly as you can because the market goes up over time. But it doesn't mean that each individual person will strike exactly at the right. You know, if a million people did it, they'd benefit on aggregate by investing earlier rather than later, because that's just the reality of the market. But some of those people will accidentally or, you know, unfortunately do it on the day before a market crash and then hate me. Others will do it the day before a market boom and love me. The average will still be high. But, you know, realistically, it's kind of a psychological decision far more than it is a purely rational economic one. The only rational choice would be if I knew that the average was going to go up over time to get in as quickly as possible. But the psychological realities of doing that, and to some degree, as Doc said before, by the way, buying in thirds, not saying you're always going to buy the second and third thirds. It's just a starter position so you can watch the business and add more if it appeals to you. That's also super smart. So I think buying slowly probably for most people is the most sensible approach. Any more on that one, mate?
I have nothing to add, sir.
All right. So here's the second part of Bernard's question / comment. Adding up what? A few weeks ago, someone wrote in that adding up was hard. Yes, it is. Now, this is not mathematical adding up. This is David Gardner adding up. And David Gardner, Doc, you're more a David Gardner devotee than I am. But effectively, you know, people say, I double down. When the stocks are down, I'm going to double down. I'm going to add more money to a falling position. David Gardner's general approach, not exclusively, but general approach, is to add up. In other words, he buys more when the shares are already up. And that's a rule-breaking idea. Not many people aim to do that. Most people, as the share price go up, think, oh, I missed the opportunity. I'm not going to buy that. But if it falls, I'll buy some more. David's point is if great businesses are doing great things, the share price should go up. But equally, if they keep doing great things, you should be happy to add more. Is that a fair summary from your perspective of the concept of adding up the David Gardner way?
Yeah, the adding up basically is all about adding on business performance, right? I mean, the business performance typically results in share price actually moving upwards. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thinking behind this is that, you know, market is actually, while it's bumping the price up, market is really not that good at thinking out, well, what this means in terms of, you know, the long term, and therefore there's still upside left, which is why you can add on the way up, because typically these are growth companies with long, you know, runways for growth and things like that. So
nice. Thank you, Matt. So Bernard goes on, I am a recovering value trap victim, and here's a tip for getting around this shortcoming that I heard on a USA podcast from one of their listeners. This works for me, so I thought I'd pass it on. What I do is take a look at my portfolio as a whole. I list my positions by the percentage they make up in my portfolio and what percentage gain the position has made since I bought them. So you've got company, then the portfolio proportion, then the percentage gain in three columns. I then divide the percentage gain by the position percentage of the portfolio. Stick with us here. He says, for example, if I held shares in the Cell Food Company and had risen 50% and made up 5% of my portfolio, I would divide 50 the gain by 5 the percentage in the portfolio, giving the position number 10 in total. I'd then compare that value against all other position values in my portfolio. Comparing the two, I then have a simple screen that would tell me to consider buying more of one company, it had a higher total. So if a total was above 10 in this case, they'd buy more instead of buying the lower total. So in other words, if the gain was great and it's a higher percentage, worth buying more. The higher the final number, the more I should consider increasing that position in my portfolio, he says. I do then quickly look at other info too, but not deeply. It's only a screen, but it works to counteract the bargain hunter value trap victim that I can be. Bear in mind, I don't trade in and out of positions. I don't buy the dip. I'm waiting for a bump in the share price. And I buy and hold long. He says lots of G's. Also, if memory serves me correctly, David doesn't exactly mean don't ever buy on the dip, as we said. All right. He said, give it a go. Prove it to yourself. Don't believe the fools. Then take some theoretical positions in a mock portfolio and see what happens for you when you do it. See how you feel. It's training. He says, thoughts, maestros? What do you reckon, Doc? Is that one way to do it? Look at the combination of the waiting and the gain and use both of those as a way to overcome that bias, almost kind of program your buying or use a simple formula to kind of take some of the emotion, the concern, the worry out of it?
Maybe. It's an interesting thought though, right? But the only thing I can think of is there's a chance you can get overweight a particular position by this model, right? It's one
He uses the denominator as the size of the portfolio, which would decrease that number. The ratio he's calculating is lower if the denominator is higher. So the higher the proportion, the harder it is to add more is kind of his idea, but it still isn't impossible if the gain's been big. It also does push up both the gain and the percentage at the same rate. In theory, he's trying to make it counteracted, but it doesn't do it entirely exactly.
Yeah. So, I do something. I'll tell you what I do. I try to go for positions I think I have high conviction in. I have a theoretical threshold of how much cash I will put,
right,
and at max, and then at that point basically stop.
Yeah, as a percentage of the portfolio, is that your threshold?
Yeah, at a given point in time, as a percentage of portfolio, that this is how much I will invest maximum in total dollar values. Actually, not even like in percentage, right? Someone says think in terms of absolute dollar value.
Now, okay.
And you say, well, why, right? Well, here's the thing, right? If $10,000 is 5% of your portfolio, as an example, it might mean different things than, say, $100,000 being 5% of your portfolio, right? Because while $100,000 may be 5%, and $10,000 might be 5%, but $100,000 technically, just you think in the absolute dollar terms, right, may mean different things. And you can use any other number, whether it's 10,000 or 100,000. But, you know, sometimes the absolute dollar value also means something, right? And I sometimes look at that and say, well, you know, that's a lot of capital in one company. And therefore, there's no reason for that, you know, the capital infusion to be any higher than that. It's not perfect. Again, you have to always find something that works for you. And I think that's my bottom line, is that you need to really find something that works for you. Right. If you've got a position, you know, you can call it 3%, but if that 3% position means something to you in other ways, then maybe that's important for you to consider.
Nice, I like that. Mate, Bernard finishes with a nice bit of encouragement, a bit of praise for us, so I'm not going to complain, but a nice bit of encouragement for our listeners as well. He says, for new listeners to Motley Fool, hang in there. The Motley Fool people have totally changed the financial direction of my family. They will for you too. Now, we can't make that promise, but Bernard could certainly mention that. I should say that past performance is no guarantee, but Bernard didn't. I just have to because that's our job. He says, I'm amazed that I can now gain more in a day than I do in a month in my social service job. I love my job, but I didn't take a vow of poverty to work in it. So investing helps me counteract the financial impact of my chosen field of work. I squirrel away spare cash straight into my trading and super accounts, and I try to live off only 70% of my income. Yes, it takes some sacrifice, but I find most shiny new things lose their appeal and value quickly, while my super and investments keep appreciating. And he finishes with no funny hashtag, I'm too old for that. Full on, Bernard. Bernard, thank you for the message. Thank you for the kind words. Thank you for the questions. Mate, probably more importantly, thank you for the work you do in your social service job, mate. I'm sure there are people, families, communities who are much better off for the work that you do. Hopefully, if we've been able to help you offset that financially, then great. I'm really, really pleased that we've been able to do that, mate. But thank you, most importantly, for the work you're doing with people in your community. Doc, any last thoughts on that from Bernard?
I have again nothing to add to that. I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory in its own right? So I'll let the words speak for themselves.
Beautifully. All right. So Bernard, thank you for doing that. We'll finish it there, mate. If people want to follow us or hit us up on the socials or on email, if you prefer email, That's okay. Email us info@fool.com.au. Leave us your feedback, thoughts, suggestions, comments. If you want to be on the socials, we'd encourage you to. It's fun there. Well, sometimes. It's fun if you follow the right people, by the way, and you're followed by the right people. Go to Twitter, where we all are. You can get the Motley Fool's account at @TheMotleyFoolAU. You can get Doc's account at @AnirbanMahanti. Or @TMFScottP. We're all there. It's one big foolish party. If you're on Instagram, you can't get Doc yet, though I'm pretty sure 2021 is going to be his year. I'm TMFScottP, and The Motley Fool is @TheMotleyFoolAU. And, of course, you can get us on Facebook, which Doc is almost certainly not going to be on. It's The Motley Fool Australia, or @ScottPhillipsMoney is my account. Fools, thank you for spending your Sunday afternoon, maybe your Monday morning with us, depending on when you are joining us. We appreciate you taking the time and spending a little bit of time. We hope to have made you a little bit smarter, happier, and richer in the process. Of course, if this is your first time listening and you haven't yet, please do subscribe to the podcast. You can use iTunes, you can use your favorite Android podcast app, or you can use Podcast One on any of those platforms. They will notify you when a new episode drops. That's always nice. Not sure the other apps do it, but certainly Podcast One does once you subscribe. So I kind of like that about it. I'm a newer listener using Podcast One, but it's working pretty well for me. We are part of the Podcast One family, so I'm a bit biased, but we don't get any benefit from recommending the podcast app. So whichever one works for you works for us as well. And if you do get a chance, please do leave us a rating or a review. It does help other people find the podcast. Helps people realize and understand what they're getting. Good and bad, but we prefer good if you don't mind. And of course, you can get a dose of foolishness straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next Friday with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.